This is Billy D. Williams from Command & Conquer 3, and you're listening to Gaming Steve.
Gentlemen, please put your hands together for the hardest working man in the game industry, the one-man vortex of gaming information, the man who keeps Yoshi as a family pet, ladies and gentlemen, Gaming Steve!
Hey there, welcome to Gaming Steve, the home of intelligent game discussion. I'm your host, Stephen Glicker, and in this week's show, I bring you the latest gaming news. I have an interview with Amir Ajami, the producer for Command & Conquer 3. I then have another interview, this time with Bruce Nesmith, the design director for Oblivion and Oblivion Shivering Isles by Bethesda Softworks. I then have a preview of Oblivion Shivering Isles. I then have a review of Command & Conquer 3. I then answer your mail, and then I have final thoughts. So first, I just wanted to thank Billy D. Williams, a.k.a. Lando Calrissian, for introducing me. That was very cool. I have to thank EA for doing that for me. It was actually a surprise. I did not know that Lando was going to introduce me. And I have a few others coming up throughout this podcast. And that was pretty cool. I have to admit, I feel like going to get a Colt 45 after hearing that. But yeah, I'm going to talk all about that. I actually went to EA a few weeks ago, and I really couldn't talk about it. It's actually one of the reasons why there was a slight delay in the show, is because what they do in the industry, if you don't know this, is that they do what's called putting things on embargo. And what they do is that they'll give people review copies of games in the industry ahead of time, but then they put an embargo on, which means you can't talk about it or give information about the game until a certain date. And that prevents people from scooping each other out. And I was allowed to talk about some aspects of the game previously, but I wanted to cover it all at once. I didn't want to drib and drab it over time. And since it's coming out today, I figured this would be timely. And also, I also got to play quite a bit of Oblivion Shivering Isles, and I met with Bethesda, so I figured I'd also kind of smush that in. So, yeah, it's been a few weeks since my last podcast at the Game Developers Conference, but I figured I'd make it up to you guys by having two awesome interviews with two incredibly highly anticipated titles, and then give you my thoughts of each one. Again, a preview of Oblivion, because I only got to play it for a few hours, so I don't feel I have enough information to give you a true review, and then a true review of Command & Conquer 3, because I've definitely played that one enough to give you my opinion. A few other things just to let you guys know is I am actually trying to get back into the swing of things. I'm actually moving, and that actually is going to be nice because I will actually have a private area to record the show on a regular basis. And that's sort of been the biggest issue. It's just places to record the show when you have two very tiny kids and a two-bedroom apartment. There's nowhere really to record the show. And then the way I work is I have my own company, but I work for a lot of other companies. So I work out of my house, and my office really is not conducive to recording. It's very loud, and it would be terrible. It actually sounds atrocious there. So I can't really do it there. Yeah, so that's where we are with that. And also, look on the site, because it is going through a revamp. That's another issue, actually, kind of why I stopped for a little while, is that the software that I'm using to run the site just got too cumbersome to the point that even I couldn't update the site. And that really was kind of a big problem. And I'm using Movable Type, and the people who run Movable Type, it's a good program because it's incredibly customizable, and 2 years ago I felt it was a good program to use, but it just got, even the people I was using, people who wrote the program, they couldn't figure out how to fix it for me. And this took months, and if they couldn't figure out how to fix it, then I kind of gave up, and I just sort of patched it together, made it work as good as it can. And I'm in the process of upgrading to a super industrial strength software that can take millions and millions of hits. It's being used in some of the most popular and biggest blog-esque programs and websites out there, so I know for a fact this thing is pretty industrial strength and could take a ridiculous amount of traffic, and plus it's fully supported by someone I trust. So that is going on, and so look for an update to the site soon. And also, way back when, a long time ago, I was asking for writers, and one of the reasons why I never really followed up with that is because the site really wouldn't handle more people. Heck, it didn't even handle me. I couldn't even get into the site. But now with the new software, that should be a thing of the past, and I'll try to follow up on that again. Once the new software is up, we'll really be able to follow up on that, and that should be up in a few weeks, and there are going to be a lot of changes to the site in general. So with that, let's get to the game news.
Gaming news.
So I was looking through the news in the last week, and not a ton of exciting things, so I'm going to kind of get through this quick so we can get to the fun interviews. Let's see. The February U.S. sales by NPD, according to them, was up 28%. So, and what is interesting about the sales is that, of course, Nintendo and the DS and the Wii are leading the way, with the DS selling 485,000 systems just in February alone and 335,000 Wiis, while the Xbox 360, 228,000, and PSP and PlayStation 3, much lower, 176,000, 127,000. More interestingly is the actual games that were sold. The Wii and the DS, four of the top 10 games are for them, five 360 games, and only one game, but that was for the PS2, and that was Guitar Hero 2. I imagine this month it's going to be a big difference, probably have Guitar Hero up there and God of War 2, which I'm playing right now, and man, that is, it's really, really good. Not enough to review it because I haven't quite finished it. I'm almost at the end, but I don't know. It's not quite as good as the original, but I mean, you know, we're talking about, you know, subtle differences. You know, it's still an absolutely fantastic game. But what's also kind of crazy is I've been looking. There's no real good place. There's a site, Video Game Charts, and it's totally unofficial. But they do a fairly good job of trying to, you know, take data from various sources and compile it. And unofficially, the Xbox 360 sold a little bit under 10 million. 10 million worldwide, it's about 9.66 million. But the Wii is sold almost or around 6 million units, and that's just in 4 months. And I believe it because I don't know where you guys live, but in New York, it is 100% impossible to find this thing. You just can't find it. It's totally sold out. They are not in any of the stores. I check every so often. I mean, luckily I have one, but I bought mine on eBay, actually. I bought mine on eBay from someone who lived in Manhattan, you know, so I was able to just, you know, quickly meet him and just get it from him in person, and luckily didn't have to pay too much more, just a little bit more than retail. But it is very hard to find. So if you can find it out there, I would suggest you buy it. And if you want to try to sell it to someone who lives in New York, I think you'll be very successful. And the PS3, it's about 2.67 million units. So, you know, the PS3 and the big thing with these numbers, and one thing is that I didn't copy the story down, but one thing I love to see is the way they spin these things. It's like, depending upon who you read, everyone won. So, like, you know, the Wii said they were, you know, Nintendo said that they were the best-selling system. Xbox 360, I forgot exactly what their press release said, but, you know, they liked the best-selling game, and they would tout that. And then, of course, Sony would say that the PlayStation brand was the best-selling brand. You know, what they do is they take, you know, the PS2 and the PS3 and, you know, anything PlayStation related, combine it all together and say, okay, we're winning because our brand is doing well. So, you know, it's always spun according to the way they want it to be spun. So, but, you know, I'm going to talk about this later in the end. You know, I don't know why this. I guess it's interesting from sort of a voyeuristic standpoint to see who's, quote, winning the war. But you know what? I don't care. It's like, I just want to play good games. I mean, I'm playing games on the PS2 right now. I'm playing a really great game on my PSP, the Ratchet and Clank game. I really like that a lot. You know, I play games on my DS. I'm playing games on my PC. I'm playing games on the Wii. You know, if there was a really good game that came out for the Xbox, I'd play that, you know. It really doesn't matter. And hopefully soon we're going to start seeing some nice games coming out for the PS3. And then I'll be a little bit more excited about it. You know, just unfortunately just not really a lot out there. But the graphics really are fantastic if you have an HD TV. And I'm looking forward to seeing them use that correctly. Next up, Take-Two fights Thompson. You know, usually I hate to mention Mr. Jack Thompson in any way, shape, or form. I have an unofficial ban of him on the show and the site because I just don't want to give him any more press than necessary. But this is strange, is that Take-Two actually sued him. And they sued him in because he was, of course, it was a preemptive strike because he was going to probably sue Take-Two to prevent Grand Theft Auto 4 and Manhunt 2 or any of their games to come out in Florida, and they were going to be trying to declare them a public nuisance. And he did this last year with Bully, and it really came down to the wire where he requested to see the game ahead of time and personally, you know, review it for people and, you know, of course, condemn it. And It this lawsuit basically, if I remember correctly, came within a few days of the actual release of the game, and that's a terrible distraction because to just release these games really requires a tremendous amount of effort. Things are going crazy. You'd be amazed how, you know, these games, they get to the very last second, and then there's bugs in them, and they're trying to fix them up in the production and the distribution, and the last thing they need is like a big lawsuit in the middle of this. PR, press, there's just so much going on, and it's just incredibly complex, and then to throw in something like a lawsuit is just too much for them. So I can see this. Jack Thompson countersued them, but his countersuit was bizarre to say the least. He had millions of Bible references in there, and I'm not going to get into that, but I've actually seen that before. I've been involved in quite a few lawsuits of myself with my company where I've had to sue people, and actually we've always won, but a few of the times, like, well, one of my earliest lawsuits, a person refused to pay me because they wanted a raise. It's a little complex, but long story short is they were getting paid by the publisher, and then I was getting paid as a developer, and the person I was getting paid for wanted more money, and they refused to pay me until they got more money. And then I tried this, you know, I basically said, well, it's not my concern, and I sued them. And the woman who I was dealing with then just started to quote scripture to me continuously, saying that it was in God's hands and, you know, this and that. And it was bizarre to say the least. And then in the end, I think she was fired and she didn't get anything. And then the publisher went with me directly. It was a total mess and total nightmare. It was actually one of the first times I've had to deal with that. But so it doesn't surprise me. But what makes this so bad is that Take-Two is suing Jack Thompson personally. And so he could be on the hook for hundreds of thousands of millions of dollars because they're going to sue him. According to this exactly, is that the publisher is seeking an injunction to prevent Thompson from filing suit to prevent the distribution of these games or even review the contents before release. Finally, the publisher wants to be reimbursed for its attorney fees and costs and be granted, quote, such other general and equitable relief as the court deems fit and proper. Now that's the part. The first two parts, I don't know if that's going to really go through because it's incredibly difficult to support that in court. But the last one is definitely supportable. And yeah, if he gets found guilty of that and has to start paying court costs for a Fortune 500 company, it could be in the millions easily, no problem there. Even if it doesn't really cost him that, they can bill that out at that. So yeah, that's why you have a corporation, so you can't get sued personally. So it's, definitely wouldn't want to be in his shoes. Sticking with Take-Two, something that was sort of a shocker is that, you know, the gaming industry was, the shareholders group a large proportion of the Take-Two shareholders, 46% of the company, of the people who own the company stock, announced that they wanted to replace the current CEO, Paul Ebner, with a former BMG president, what's his name, is Strauss Zelnick. And he also, they also wanted to reduce the number of board members from 9 to 6. So basically, they're kind of throwing a little coup d'etat within the company. Now, since they own 46% and they can vote to do this, you know, there's a very good chance this is going to go through. And it's totally in their right since they own the company. You know, the shareholders really are the people who own the company. And the board of directors are supposed to, you know, implement the shareholders' wishes and sort of, you know, best interests of the company. And again, I've actually, of course, seen this before as well, quite a bit. You know, Apple went through this a long time ago or something similar to this when Steve Jobs was brought on board. And then right after this, Take-Two postponed its annual meeting from March 23rd to March 29th, and they, you know, nonchalantly said, oh, you know, we might sell the company. And of course, the stock went through the roof, and, you know, just the titles alone, forget about, you know, the actual code or anything else, but just the brands, you know, Grand Theft Auto, even Manhunt, even Bully, you know, I mean, everything that Take-Two has is worth money. And, you know, for, you know, they could easily, you could easily buy Take-Two and Rockstar and take the brands and then just fire every single person and then just, you know, now have rights to the brands. And make no mistake, you know, Grand Theft Auto is worth probably billions of dollars, you know, definitely hundreds and hundreds of millions, if not billions. So this could be a very, you know, I'm definitely following this, you know, which killed me is because right before this happened, I was thinking of buying some Take-Two stock. It was like at $17 a share. I was like, oh, you know, I've been burned by that stock a lot, and it's just gone through so many shenanigans, and I hate to buy stocks for any company that I just don't trust the board of the directors, and I really just don't trust the Take-Two board of directors. They've just been so, they just keep getting, they keep messing up their books. They get found guilty of, you know, tampering and fraud, and but then of course the stock went up to like 23.5 immediately. So, oh well, but it's been coming back down. What else? The Black Xbox 360 has been semi-confirmed. It's weird now. For those of you who don't know, there are black Xbox 360s already out, and these are dev kits in the industry where there are people like, well, not myself because I don't actually have one, but people who are developers or actually a lot of press or some of the more prestigious press actually have these black 360s, and they're actually dev kits, and they cost like $2,000 each to build. They're incredibly hard to make, and they're made specifically so that you can, you know, play pre-released items. You know, you can buy, play games that are that haven't been released yet, or you can actually then develop on them. So when I saw these rumors that it was going to be a Black 360 coming out, I was thinking, you know, people just are seeing these pictures of Black 360 and getting confused. But it sounds like from various sources that this is true, that it's going to be called the Xbox 360 Elite. It's going to come in limited supplies only, maybe a couple hundred thousand. The case, controller, and live headset will all be black. It's going to cost around $479. It's going to be its own SKU. Let's see what else. Let's see. It's going to probably have a 120 gigabyte hard drive and HDMI inputs. Let's see. The Elite models are going to run cooler than the 360. They do not know if the HD DVD drive will be internal or bundled, probably neither, and there's also not going to be Wi-Fi. So it is one of the worst kept secrets, but it's actually a pretty good idea. Japan does this, and obviously with the Nintendo DSs and Game Boys, they do this like crazy. You know, they release limited edition versions with different colors, and it works phenomenally. I mean, Nintendo makes their whole living off selling you the same, you know, same item over and over again, just slightly repackaged, or at least with their portable systems. So, you know, I'm going to watch this one. I have a feeling this will work, and they'll be successful if they release a limited edition, you know, black Xbox 360. It'll definitely get them back into the press, which it's done already, and sort of give them, you know, a little bit of oomph, you know, to compete against the Wii and even the PS3 in the marketplace, and in the press. So, I'd be very curious. Of course, this could then start the, you know, I guess limited edition wars, if you would. You know, already with the faceplates, you know, it's getting kind of crazy. Like I have, Gears of War has a faceplate, and but if you went to E3, they gave you a custom faceplate that you can only get if you actually went to E3 and played Gears of War. So there's, you know, maybe a few hundred of these in total existence. I have one, and I didn't realize I was looking at eBay. These things were going like for $400 or $500 each, which I think is kind of silly, quite frankly. But I do admit it's the only faceplate I've ever put on my Xbox 360 because it looks awesome. So maybe it is worth it. I don't think it's worth $400 or $500, but it's definitely cool. You don't know Jack. So this is almost like my retro review. I don't have a retro review right today, but if you have never played You Don't Know Jack, there was these trivia games that came out in the 90s by this company called Jellyvision. They look gorgeous. It was sort of like cool Flash animation before Flash existed. And it's nothing more than a trivia contest, but it has fantastic animation. It has beautiful voiceovers and sound effects. It is just stunning visually to look at, and there's no graphics almost. It's all text treatments, but it's a testament to just incredible design, both physically as well as, you know, gameplay wise. And they are up and it are free. If you go to, I think it's youdontknowjack.com. I can't believe I didn't write it down. It's not in the article either. Well, I'm 90% sure it's youdontknowjack.com, but they're supposedly, they're all up, they're all free, and every single Monday they're going to have a brand new You Don't Know Jack that you can play. And the other thing is you can play it against other people. You can all sit, how it works is you all sit around the keyboard, and then you just, you press a button when you think you know the answer. But what makes it crazy is that the second, you know, if it's in the middle of talking, the second you press the button, it stops and you have to answer right away. But seriously, if you haven't played this game, give it a try, especially if you're a trivia buff. I would be stunned if you don't love this game. And this is a great gateway game. I'm really surprised this game hasn't showed up on Xbox Live Arcade. This would be a fantastic, phenomenal game. I'm actually really surprised trivia games aren't on Xbox Live Arcade or really any consoles in general. They're so popular, especially with like the internet and the, you know, on the Wii, it would be very good. It's just, you know, I really love trivia games, and you know, you go to bars, they're very popular where you can play multiplayer against other bars, and I'm surprised. Next up, Microsoft probes possible Xbox Live fraud. This one's a confusing article because, okay, let me see if I can follow this all. There's been these reports last week that there was hijacked accounts, and then Microsoft said, and people were getting charged money that they shouldn't be. Microsoft said, no, it's not true. And then today, Major Nelson said, maybe there is some proof of this, of some, you know, hijacked accounts. They're going to have to take a look at it. Now, I actually myself noticed, I was doing my credit card a few weeks ago, I had a charge for Xbox Live, and my account is good for like 4 years or something. I have so many of those free cards, I just entered them all in, and I haven't bought anything recently. I haven't even think I've used my Xbox 360 to play a game on for about a month now. I've been between the Wii, the PC, and my PS2, so I myself was wondering what the heck. I was going to call them up and find out where that come from, because I don't think I charged. So, and I haven't spoken to anyone, so I myself might be, I don't know, like wondering about this. So let me know if anyone else out there is having some weird things with their, it wasn't a big charge. I think it was only like $4.95, but still it's, you know, I didn't buy anything. I haven't even used it. So where'd that charge come from? So, I'll follow the story as it develops, but it seems to be just more confusion than actual story at this point. That supposedly they're like, well, it's social engineering, and that's how they got these credit cards, so, or that's how they got these, you know, charges. But again, I haven't been talking to anyone, so I don't know how that would be possible. I'll quickly wrap up I want to get to the other stuff, so let me just quickly go through these last two news items. New Wii browser is coming out in April. Let's see, there's going to be a update to the Wii, and it's going to be a browser Opera-based. You know, it's weird. It's like people talk about this, and people get really excited about, ooh, you know, there's going to be a web browser. You know, remember the Sega, not the Sega Saturn, the Dreamcast had a web browser in it. It was really, got a lot of press, and people are excited, and it totally stunk. I mean, it was, you know, it was all right, but you know, I guess maybe, you know, this can be cool, but, you know, web browsing on my Wii, I have a computer. Actually, I have something like 6 computers. You know, I have laptops. If I really want to web browse while I'm playing the Wii, I'll just pull up my laptop and start doing it. So, I don't know. I mean, you need an internet connection to get to it. So it's not like this is giving you something that you don't, probably wouldn't have access to already. I mean, if you have an internet connection, you probably have a computer. Therefore, you would have access to this. So, yeah, I'm not quite sure why this is such a big deal. Maybe just because it's cool. Maybe I'm missing something. Anyhow, it's going to be available for free to download until the end of June, and then after that, it's going to cost 500 Wii points, and there's been a beta version available since December, so check it out before it costs you money. And then finally, the PS3 finally went overseas and hit the UK shelves. It did pretty well. It was, I think, the best-selling console in UK history. It sold 165,000 in 2 days. The launch weekend, so that's pretty damn good. On top of that, Sony gave out to some lucky people in lines for some of the midnight lines a Bravia 46-inch HDTV, and of course the people were stunned and very happy about that. But they, you know, sort of addresses an issue is that in the UK only about 15% of homes have HDTVs, and even in the United States only about 25% of homes have HDTVs. Now obviously the people that are buying these systems, there's probably an incredibly high number of people who are buying 360s and PS3s and Wii's and have HDTV. I mean, of course, I've had it since, I don't know, day one, and I'm sure most of you out there have them as well. But, you know, the average consumer doesn't have it. And, you know, that's sort of a main issue when they keep saying, oh, how great this is and how it has HDTV. And I'm talking about all the systems. But, you know, if you don't have it, that's not a big selling point to you because you don't have the, you know, if anything, it almost makes you feel like, well, it's waste. And why should I spend that extra money for something I'm not going to use? So that, I think, can backfire on people if not handled correctly. Well, that's it for the news, and with that, let's get to my interviews.
This is Trisha Helfer from Command & Conquer 3, and you're listening to Gaming Steve.
Interview! Hey, thank you so much, Trisha Helfer. Yes, that's number 6 from Battlestar Galactica. I might just use her to introduce my show from now on, because I could probably listen to that all day. That was pretty nice. Anyhow, let's get to the interview. I did interview Amir Ajami. He's the producer for Command & Conquer 3, and he's going to talk about, well, guess what? That's right, Command & Conquer 3. So let's stop listening to me, and let's talk to Amir.
Hey, this is Gaming Steve. I'm sitting here with Amir Ajami, the producer for Command & Conquer 3. How are you doing, Amir?
I'm doing fine, Steve. Good to have you on board.
Thanks for having me. I'm actually here at EA, and we've been playing Command & Conquer 3 for a couple days now, trying it out. And I have to say, Amir, I'm very impressed. It actually, some people were worried that, you know, this is the first time it's not being done by True Westwood, and it's being done by EA, and that, you know, you might not have gotten the Command & Conquer feel to the game, right. But I would say that this actually feels more like Command & Conquer than probably any game I've played since probably Red Alert.
We certainly have a lot of CNC fans on the team, you know, myself being one of them. I remember the very first time I saw Command & Conquer. I had snuck into E3 in 1995, and it was, they had the full motion video cutscenes on the big screens at the Westwood booth, and I had never played an RTS game before, and I saw those cutscenes. I didn't know what kind of game that was, and frankly, I didn't care. I just knew I had to play it, and since then, I've been, you know, just a diehard fan of CNC, and really to be working on CNC 3, for me personally, is a huge dream come true. And, you know, there are days when I have to pinch myself that I'm actually working on the third in a very storied franchise.
So what were some of your goals you were setting out to accomplish with CNC 3? Because you guys managed to keep the old school feel to the game, yet it feels, you know, brand new. It's much, much faster. It's probably the fastest RTS I've ever played. All the, you know, units are there. GDI plays like GDI. You know, Nod plays like Nod. You got the same characters. Like, what, you know, it's new, but yet old at the same time.
Yeah, and, you know, you kind of hit the nail on the head regarding what our biggest challenge was going into the development of this game. We knew that we were going to make a CNC game, but we had this challenge on our hands that was, how do you create something that's new? You know, we're releasing an RTS game in 2007, and the genre has progressed in the 12 years since the first CNC came out. And yet, how do you retain the feel of a classic CNC game? And what is the feel of a classic CNC game? What was it that defined that? And we kind of broke it down into several elements, and we knew that one of them was the full motion video cutscenes. So we knew that we wanted to bring those back. We knew that we wanted to have Kane back. You know, Kane has kind of been killed off in every CNC game, and every subsequent game he comes back to life. So we wanted to keep that tradition alive. And we couldn't really bring Kane back without having Joe Coogan reprise his role. So that was kind of a no-brainer to us. The other elements are like the UI sidebar. Bring that back because that kind of adds to the fast-paced feel of the game. It lets you build and queue up units while you're focusing on the battlefield. You don't have to be hovering over your base to queue up structures and queue up units. And yet, when we developed BFME 1 and 2, we learned a lot of lessons since that game was designed for the casual players. And so we do let you click on individual units and click on individual structures to access contextual-based actions from from the game. And then it's just the overall speed of the game. So, you know, we knew that people love StarCraft. They love RA2. That's what they play competitively. And that's a big goal that we had for CNC 3. So we just cranked the speed up to 11 on CNC 3. And I think we succeeded in doing that.
So the full motion video cutscenes, I've heard a lot of mixed things about this. People are like, oh, they're old-fashioned and they slow down gameplay and, you know, they're, you know, not necessary. But yet, someone like myself who's not a big multiplayer, you know, player, I like to play the first player. You know, I look forward to them. You know, it's incentive. The way back when it was the very first CNC, it's an incentive to go through the campaign to see what happens next. And they're fun. I mean, they're cheesy a little, you know.
Just a little.
Yeah, so exactly. You know, you they kind of hook you along, and then they give you an incentive to keep playing, you know, mission after mission, and you tell yourself, well, I'm just going to play one more mission, and then you get a cool little cutscene with Kane or Killian telling you some cheesy lines, and you go, all right, I'll play one more mission just because I want to see what comes next. And that was a big risk for us, you know, because, you know, the genre has progressed, and people have stopped using full motion video in games, and we were worried that if we were going to do that, people were going to think that we were old-fashioned, and so, but I think we did a good job. You know, we really focused on the production values, and we really wanted topical stars. So people like Josh Holloway from Lost, and the, you know, half the cast practically from Battlestar Galactica, and you know, Billy Dee from Star Wars. So it's a very topical and like geek-centric cast, and the production values, like I said, were pretty phenomenal. I mean, it's what you would see from like a Battlestar Galactica on any given weeknight on Sci-Fi Channel. So, you know, when you couple the cast and the production values, I think we did a good job of kind of, bringing full motion video to the year 2007 without seeming cheesy and without seeming, you know, a retro just for the sake of being retro.
Yeah, I mean, people think, oh, it's cheesy, it's old-fashioned, but yet, you know, we met some of the production people. We met Dragon, yeah, who actually did all the props for it, and we saw behind the scenes of how you guys put these things together. I mean, this thing must have cost a fortune, and the technology behind this was phenomenal. People are, oh, yeah, they're just full-motion video cutscenes. They're not. This was ridiculous.
Yeah, no, it was certainly not cheap. Yeah, the finance guys don't really like us now. Not a whole lot. But, you know, it was worth it. You know, we had to do what was right by the game, what was right by CNC, and, you know, no matter the cost, we had a vision, and we stuck to it, and you know, I think that when people like you and other fans of the game, of the series, play this game, I think they'll appreciate all the millions of dollars that we spent.
So, I don't know how much we're allowed to talk about it, but I'll bring up the Scrim, the third faction. The
Scrim. Yes.
The Scrim. We'll try to talk about it in such a way that doesn't spoil it for people that want to play the game, but there is a third faction. It's not a big surprise that there is one. Once the reviews come out, they're going to be talking about it quite a bit. What was the reasoning to add a third faction? Was it to make it more competitive with StarCrafts of the world? Was it, you know, because you also have a commentary module in there, which I'll talk about in a sec, but what was the real thinking behind that?
Well, just having two factions didn't seem like it was going to be a meaty RTS game. Like these days, the price of entry for an RTS developer is at least three factions. At least that's how we look at it. And, you know, the Skryn were alluded to in Tiberian Sun with the Tacitus, and we wanted to move that fiction forward, and it seemed like an excellent time to do that. That's why. I mean, it was kind of a no-brainer. We all knew, like, as soon as we started talking about CNC 3, like, three factions and the Skryn were, you know, were givens. It was, we didn't put much, not a lot of people argued for two factions and or not including the Skryn.
And how did they play? You know, obviously GDI is a sort of a powerful faction, and Nod is sort of the fast but not so powerful faction. You have to be a little tricky with them. The Skryn, I played them quite a bit, and I still can't quite figure out how they play.
Yeah, they're kind of a combination of GDI and Nod. You described it accurately. GDI is kind of like the slow brooding but very powerful faction. Nod, you know, employs guerrilla tactics, so they're faster, but on a unit by unit basis. They're relatively weaker when compared to GDI. So you take those two characteristics and you blend them together, and that's what you get with the Skryn. You get factions that early game are fast and light and mobile but very weak, and late game are slow and brooding like the Tripod and the Devastator warships and the Planetary Assault Carriers and the Mothership, but extremely powerful. So the trick is, if you play as the Skryn, you've got to hold out long enough to get to those late game units, and then, you know, your opponent's in trouble.
Can you even use that Mothership? I saw that thing. That thing moves so slow. Is that even a viable weapon?
Yeah. So I'm gonna give you a little piece of strategery, as they say, that I noticed our lead AI engineer using. And so the Mothership is cast from the signal transmitter. Once you have one of those things, it costs $5,000 to essentially cast, you know, summon a Mothership instantly. Well, if you build a signal transmitter in your base. You said it right. It takes forever to move that Mothership, and it's super vulnerable. It can take a lot, but it moves so slow that, you know, it almost always dies before it gets to the enemy's base. But if you sneak an engineer into an enemy's base and you capture any structure, you get buildability around that structure. If you have a signal transmitter already ready, pre-built in your UI, you just drop it right there and instantly cast that Mothership, and then you have a Mothership hovering over your enemy's base. Because its weapon chain reacts, you just fire it anywhere in that base, and then the entire base is destroyed. And I think everyone's going to be doing that day one because I spoiled it. But.
That's okay. I mean, people will figure it out. But yeah, so the mother base is the super weapon for the...
It's actually not the super weapon. They have a super weapon called the Rift Generator.
Oh, right.
That's the structure, and the super weapon itself is called the Rift. But no, that's just another kind of superpower that they can cast, similar to, you know, every faction has a bunch of left-hand powers that are tied to specific structures that the players can cast, and that's just one of them. And it just happens to be huge and extremely powerful.
And very, very cool. So the commentary technology that you guys added to this, and we've been fooling around with it here. So again, it seems like you guys are really focusing on making this available for tournament play, making this available for, you know, people who run the tournaments to easily commentate on these. And on top of that, it's pretty small. I heard that, you know, once it's all said and done, the files are a meg, most 2 megs, yeah, for everything in there.
Yeah, exactly. Basically, we're adding functionality that we call a lot of things. RTS is a sport. You might have heard us refer to it. Match broadcast, battlecast. But basically, it revolves around our website, commandandconquer.com. And you go there, and under the battlecast section, we basically list every single replay of every single game that was ever played of CNC3. And you can go in and double-click on the replay that you want to watch, and it will automatically launch the game, and you can watch that replay. You can also do that for live games that are happening right now as you're surfing the website. And we also let you schedule future matches. So the website also acts like a TVguide.com, essentially, where you can search for matches that are being played by, like, you know, let's say Hero and, you know, Breno are playing. You know, two of our, you know, the most competitive guys online, and you know that they're going to play on Tuesday, so you search by their names or you search by the match name, and you see that's scheduled for Tuesday. We can set a reminder for you. You can set that reminder to be every day, every hour, whatever. And then when that match is being played, you launch it and you can watch it. And like you mentioned, one person who's watching that match can be flagged as a commentator. So if they have a microphone, we use VoIP technology and give them, you know, the ability to commentate on the match, just like John Madden would do for a football match. And we give them a telestrator option as well. So if, you know, player A is going to tank rush player B, the commentator would circle those tanks and point towards the direction of the base to kind of illustrate to everyone else who's watching what's happening. So there's just a couple of tools that we use to kind of... you know, we recognize that esports and tournament play is huge, and it's certainly bigger elsewhere than it is in the U.S., especially in Korea and Germany. And we want, you know, to be blunt, we want a piece of that pie, and we want to see it explode in the U.S. So that's one of the reasons why we've done so much with RTS as a sport.
Is that going to work on the 360 as well, or is that just the PC?
So the match broadcast functionality is just for the PC, but of course the 360 has Xbox Live and everything that comes with that. And one of the cool things that they're doing with Live is they're supporting the Vision Cam, which is the 360
right,
camera.
I saw that.
You know, imagine a four-player match with you know, an actual live feed of everyone in that match. And then the winner of any given match gets his image to be you know, scaled up to the size of your TV monitor, and he gets like a 10-second window to trash talk everybody else, and they can't quit out of that. So you have to sit there and take it from the winner of the match as he rubs it in your face.
So we got on the PC, we got on the 360. Any chance for the PS3? I know some people have been hoping it'll come out since it has more power, more memory.
Right. Right now, there are no plans to do anything other than the PC and 360. But, you know, we reserve the right to release more games in the future.
And then finally, since we have to wrap this up, I'm just curious about how long you guys were working on this, because, you know, only 10 months ago at E3, it was first announced. Mm-hmm. And then I was here in November, and you guys were kind of almost done with the game. And now it's, you know, or you guys were balancing it, and now it's done. I mean, that's obviously you're working on it beforehand, but that's pretty unbelievably fast.
Yeah, well, I mean, remember, we get paid to do this, so we kind of know what we're doing. But this game has been in development by a smaller team for about 6 months before the full team came on board. So really, it's been an 18-month project, if you consider that. We started doing concept work and kind of the high-level thinking in August of 05. Like while we were working on BFME2, and then when we wrapped BFME2, that's when we just brought the whole team over, and from then it was a year out. So a year with a full team, 18 months with a smaller core conceptual team, and yeah, it was just, you know, it's a fast RTS game, and we developed it quickly. And I think I messed up that analogy, but you get the idea.
Yeah. No, I mean, 18 months. Yeah, this is, it's amazing how quickly you guys were able to get this thing out. And it looks fantastic. It plays fantastic. I can't believe how fast it is. I mean, you could get tier 3 in less than 10 minutes. Yeah. It's just very, very fast game.
Yeah, it definitely harkens back to Red Alert 2, which is one of my favorite RTS games and one of the favorite RTS games of many people on the team.
As soon as I played it, I was thinking, oh, it's like Red Alert 2. This is the only, if not faster. That's what I liked about Red Alert 2. It was just so unbelievably fast. Although, it looks like everyone does the rush. There seems to be no turtling. I mean, I imagine maybe we'll start seeing that, but it seems to be rush is pretty much the only strategy, at least I've seen.
So professional players, you know, they don't turtle. But we have like 4 different base defenses per faction. If you want to turtle, you can certainly turtle.
Okay, Amir, I got to wrap this up, but I wanted to thank you very much, and I guess we look forward to an expansion pack coming out sometime soon.
You did not hear that from me.
All right, thanks a lot, Amir.
Thank you, Steve.
Hey, thanks a lot, Amir. And with that, let's get to the second interview. Yes, that's right. I usually never do this, but I had them, and both games are coming out the same day, and I figured, what the heck? Let's get to the second interview. This one is with Bruce Nesmith. He's the design director for Oblivion Shivering Isles, and what makes it cool is that he's the one responsible for the leveling system. That's right. So we talk about that quite a bit, so you'll find out kind of the secrets and kind of why they did that in the first place. So let's take it away with Bruce.
Hey, this is Gaming Steve, and I'm sitting down with Bruce Nesmith, the director of design, senior game designer for Shivering Isles, the expansion for Oblivion. How are you doing today, Bruce?
I'm doing great.
Thanks for having me here.
And we are going to talk about Shivering Isles. We're going to talk about Oblivion for the PS3. And let's get right into it. So Shivering Isles is the first official expansion for Oblivion. Even though there's been lots of other things, like there was the Heroes of Nine or the Knights of the Nine. And then there's the horse armor that everyone knows about and the dungeons and the additional quests. But this is the first official expansion.
That's correct. This is the big one. This is the expansion that really makes a substantial extension to the game.
And this one is different because it's not just a little bit more. We're actually putting in around 30 hours. There's a whole gigantic quest that you can jump in any time. There's a whole bunch of new monsters. Why don't you talk a little bit about what you're going to get with this?
Well, we decided to give you everything new. So you have a complete new land with its own map that you can go to. All of the artwork in there is new, all the trees are new, all the landscapes new, all the creatures are new, all the weapons, the armor, everything is new. You have new characters that you'll run into for interacting with, like the guards, the Dark Seducers, and the Golden Saints. So you get a really large play space. It's roughly a quarter the size of all of Cyrodiil. So it's a really substantial thing. I mean, we're really giving you a lot of gameplay there.
That's why this is called an official expansion.
That's correct. As opposed to just a simple downloadable content, although this is a downloadable piece, but it is a real expansion.
So what makes Shivering Isles an actual expansion as opposed to, you know, just a downloadable content? What were you guys trying to actually accomplish in this version that you weren't able to do in just a downloadable content?
The idea that Mark Nelson, the lead designer for the project, had was to try and take a different twist on fantasy. Instead of the traditional Arthurian style, Lord of the Rings style fantasy that we had with Oblivion, we wanted to take a more high fantasy approach. Something that harkened back to maybe Morrowind for those people who really loved that game. So we gave you everything new. And we tried to make it all be a little bit twisted. So you've got your own play space, you've got all the new creatures in the armor and the world that you would be in. And we decided to set it against the backdrop of Shai-Gorath, the Daedric Prince of Madness. And this would be the theme that we had. So this expansion set is really for people who want to experience something a little out of the ordinary, a little bit unusual, and have a different kind of fun. And we think they'll really enjoy it.
And also, you can start this at any point. I mean, I was playing it just now for a while, and you can literally go from building your character right to the new land, from level one. You don't have to worry about when, you know, it doesn't have to be inserted at any special time. You can just start if you want to play the game from a brand new character, you can do that. Or if you want to take your Uber character that you finished the game with, you can do it that way too.
Yeah, so that was a particular challenge because obviously the thing that you would immediately think to do would just be to extend the game for high level play. But there's a lot of people who haven't reached that level, and we want them to be able to enjoy the Shivering Isles also. So we actually made great efforts to make sure that the game was available to everyone at any part in their gameplay and still provide some new challenges for people who have already peaked in Oblivion, have seen all the creatures, have gotten all the best loot. Now they have something new they can get. So as soon as you exit character generation, as soon as you get out of that dungeon, you can get a message that'll say, hey, this new content's available. It's over here in this weird new island that popped up in Nibbin Bay. And you can go there or not go there. You can wait till you're level 30. You can do it when you're level 1 or anything in between.
So let's talk about the Shivering Isles themselves. So I don't want to give away too much, especially for people who want to be surprised, but we'll talk a little bit, so I'm giving a little bit of warning. So you have some strange stuff going on. I mean, right away, when you jump on the isle, you know, it's definitely, everything's a little twisted, a little odd. You're fighting a monster that's about 3 times the size of you, which is nice. You're actually seeing things that are titanic in size. And then the isle itself is divided into sort of a light and dark area. You want to talk about that?
Well, the land itself is a reflection of its creator. It's a reflection of Shai-Gorath. And Shai-Gorath, being the Daedric Prince of Madness, is himself somewhat split. I mean, he has a mania and a dementia side, which is what we've named the two parts of the physical land you're in. And because it's an expression of him, the mania side has got all these oversaturated colors and all this hyper growth and all these strange things. In the dementia side, you see all these twisted dead life forms, and all of the creatures are more gray and look more death-like. So you've got these two halves of the world. And every creature, I shouldn't say every, most creatures that you find have expressions in both. So, for instance, you might find a Grummite in the mania side. He's really brightly colored. He's real animated. And you go down into the dementia side, and you find he's blues and purples, and he's more of a reflection of that land.
And there's obviously a main quest that you have to sort of work between the two aisles. Again, I don't want to give too much away, but you can start seeing where this is going, is that you have to obviously work between these two aisles to solve some issues.
Well, Sheogorath has invited you here for a reason, and it is an invitation. And he wouldn't do that unless he had something he wanted from you. So you have to help him out with that, and he's going to pose you a problem. And as that quest develops, you'll find that the problem sort of changes its character and dimension. And some interesting twists and surprises there. And once again, without giving away too much. But you are going to be running errands for him for a little while, but will make you do some rather bizarre things.
So with that being said, what else is in the game? You know, obviously, you know, so we know, okay, new quests, cool new land, cool new monsters. But you also, you know, let's touch about there's armor that's new to this land that you can't get anywhere else. And you were saying before that it sort of fills in the gap of the existing armor in Oblivion.
I think this is one of the things the players are really going to like. You can find in the world the raw materials for building armor. And you can take them to these smiths that are in town. And you can build armor custom-made for yourself, both magical and non-magical. And the way the armor was put together by the game designers, it is meant to fit in between the normal levels of the regular armor. So if you've got the best armor you can get at, say, level 12, and you haven't run across any of the next best stuff, you might already have a slightly better version that's not as good as your next set, but better than what you currently have, waiting for you in the Shivering Isles if you go there. And of course, the very best armor from the Shivering Isles is better than the stuff that you would find in Oblivion, and the same is true for the weapons. So those people who have already hit their max, they can go there and they can find some stuff that's a little bit better than Daedric out there.
So how is the Shivering Isles going to work with the existing world? I mean, already when you're talking about the armor and items, I'm thinking, you know, they're going to obviously have to mesh with the existing world perfectly. So if you're right in the middle of your main quest and then you jump to the Shivering Isles, does it reflect? Does it change according to that? If like you're in the middle of the quest, are you able to actually take on issues dealing with your main quest at all, like actually, or is it just sort of stay on its own? It's sort of still separate, and you can go on Shivering Isles, take care of everything there, do the 30 plus hours of content, Shivering Isles, complete that, then jump back to the main world and continue on your way.
You can move back and forth at will. Now, to be honest, there's a couple places in the Shivering Isles where, by the nature of the story, you're locked out for a very brief time, but basically, you can bounce back and forth. However, the only thing that really changes is you. So the actions that you take in the Shivering Isles do not change the nature of the world in Cyrodiil, even to the point where crimes that you commit and any price on your head in the Shivering Isles does not carry through to Cyrodiil and vice versa. So if you're a wanted man in the Imperial Province, you can go to the Shivering Isles and nobody has any idea that you're such a scoundrel. But your armor and weapons, for instance, you can carry them back. It will not disrupt your gameplay in Cyrodiil. Everything will work just fine, all the new spells that you find. Mm-hmm. But the separation is pretty strict beyond you as the character. For example, you can't take your horse into the Shivering Isles. You got to go there on foot. And any followers that you get in one place or the other will not transfer across. You can't take Martin in with you, for example, into the Shivering Isles.
So there's crossover, but obviously this was created as a semi-standalone content, which is actually allows you to do a lot of things that you weren't able to do. Like, for instance, even things like the weather patterns I noticed in the sky are completely different in the Shivering Isles. Like, you know, you are on a different world, and that's pretty immediate when you first even enter it, you can say, okay, you're not, it's almost like going through an Oblivion gate. You know, you are definitely in a different land. And it's cool because you're able to see and do things that you just, you know, it, even for someone like myself who's played hundreds of hours of Oblivion, immediately was new again, which was obviously, I guess, something you guys were shooting for.
Oh, yes. That's definitely the goal. We wanted it to be fresh. We wanted it to wake up people who maybe had gotten a little jaded on seeing the stuff they had seen in Oblivion. We also wanted to give you that sense of alien. We wanted to make sure that within 30 seconds of being in the Shivering Isles, you knew you were not in your daddy's role-playing game anymore. This was a new place for you. So as you say, the sky is different. You know, you come in and there's this strange, bizarre, giant mushroom tree hanging over you. There's the now famous scene with all the butterflies flying off into the distance. So there's no question this is not where you have been before, that this will all be new and you will have to think about things rather than just taking it all for granted.
So how is this going to actually work for the PC? Obviously, you can just buy it, and it's just like a regular expansion. But most people play this on the 360, and I've been getting a lot of questions like, how is that going to work? Is it downloadable content? Is it too big? What's the size of it? Is it going to take up a huge amount of space on your hard drive? Can you buy it in the stores? How is that going to work?
Currently, you will not be able to buy it in the stores for the Xbox 360. It will be available strictly as a downloadable content. It will be a pretty good sized one. I don't have the exact number in front of me, but it's over a gigabyte. So those people who have broadband, I don't think this will be an issue. There's already downloads for demos that are in excess of a gigabyte. So this is really no different than those are. Would we love to someday put it out as a retail version? You bet. And if the opportunity comes along, we will jump on it. But at the moment, it's simply going to be a downloadable piece. And I think it's probably going to be the most popular download in Xbox history, quite frankly, until the next one comes along, whatever that may be. That's one of those that everything always gets better over time.
Mm-hmm. And then for the PC, it'll just be a regular CD, DVD that you can just buy in the store and just add on.
Correct. It will only be available that way. In fact, you will not be able to download it from a download site. You will only be getting it from the store as a CD. And it will be treated just like normal expansion packs that you're used to from a variety of vendors.
So, yeah, it's hard to talk about Shivering Isles because, you know, we want to talk about it, but at the same time, I don't want to give anything away to anyone. So let's jump on to the next topic, which is the PS3. You know, a lot of people who have PS3s who might not have played this game because their PC was not powerful enough to play the original Oblivion, or they didn't have a 360. This is probably one of the very first games, or if not the second game, I'd imagine, that they're going to be buying for the PS3. So what is different on the PS3 that, was in the previous versions? I've noticed it looks like it's pretty much exactly the same game, just a lot prettier, but you guys didn't really change that much, if anything.
We make the game Oblivion for the Elder Scrolls line, and that statement is console independent. PC, Xbox, PS3, we're making a game. We don't want the game to be different on different platforms. First of all, we don't want to have to support that, but more importantly, we don't want the gamer experience to be different. We think we've made what is a pivotal, important game out there that everybody loves, and why tinker with that? Now, that said, we do have some things we're offering the PS3 community that are not immediately available for the Xbox or the PC. For example, the Knights of the Nine content comes with it. Now, you can download that onto your Xbox, but it's sort of our gift to the PS3 community. Here, you get some content for free with it that did not come for free with the other platforms. You also get the benefit of the technology updates that are already available for the Xbox and the PC, but it's coming with yours. You don't have to download those. So, for example, we have a better LOD texture rendering routine for landscape. In simpler terms, that just means the landscape's going to look better at a distance than it does on the Xbox or the PC, unless you get those downloadable updates. If you get those, it'll look the same on them, but it comes with it on the PS3. So the PS3 is going to come right out of the box looking cleaner than an out-of-the-box version of Oblivion that you may have bought a year ago, but it won't look necessarily that much better than one that you bought and then upgraded.
And what about 6-axis support? Is that even in the PS3 version?
We thought long and hard about that. We even played around with it a little bit, But in the end, we decided that our original mission statement was still the correct one, which is we want the game to be the same. And to do the six-axis stuff correctly on the PS3, we would have had to make it a different game. We would have had to do something different to really make that be to the quality we wanted it to be at. So we chose not to do that. We may address that in future games, but it's not going to be for Oblivion.
And what about downloadable content on the PS3? How is that going to be handled, if at all?
As soon as there's a mechanism for us to do it, we will be all over it. As is probably already obvious, we are all about downloadable content. We want our gaming audience to have as much as possible. We think that that's a real plus for our game. And as soon as Sony gives us an idea of how that's going to be running and how that's supposed to operate, we'll be there with it. But at the moment, there is not anything available for it.
So one thing I'm going to talk to Bruce about, because I found out just talking to him, is that he was in charge of the leveling system in Oblivion. And I'm sure everyone and his mother who played Oblivion would want to talk to Bruce, because that is probably the biggest article of contention in Oblivion, both good and bad, you know. So what was sort of how did you guys even get to the concept of the way it works in Oblivion, where that, you know, it's like, obviously you have a couple things going on. First is that everything in the world levels up with you, which is good and bad. You know, it always gives you a challenge, which is nice. But then at the same time, you know, you don't have the issue that you had in the earlier Elder Scrolls games, that very quickly you become a god and nothing is a challenge to you. But then at the same time, it's like, well, why even go up levels? You know, why? Well, there is no difference between level 1 and being level 50. You know, if everything's a challenge to you. And also even just the way your character is built. But let's talk about the first one, then I'll get to the second one.
I'm just going to sort of hit the ground running on this, so I might be skipping over your exact questions. Come back to me with some of those if I skip them unintentionally. In game development, early on, you have to make pivotal, sweeping decisions. You have to decide to go left or right on certain key issues. And in most cases, there isn't a right or a wrong answer. It's just a decision that must be made, because you can't have it both ways. And the decision you make, either direction, will have consequences. This is exactly what happened with leveling. We had to make an early decision, and we had to decide, were these the consequences we wanted, or did we want these other set of consequences? What was more palatable to us? What would provide a better experience for the gamer? And Todd Howard, the executive producer and creative driving force for Oblivion, decided early on that he wanted a game where no matter where the player went, the player would have fun. And in his opinion, and I agree with it, it is not fun to go someplace and find encounters that are not a challenge, and it is no fun to go someplace and find encounters that you cannot even handle, cannot even begin to. And that made us choose right versus left. And that made us decide, well, we need a system that will allow us to make sure that the challenge the player faces is always one that's appropriate to him. And this way, the players will always have fun. Now, you made a statement earlier that what does it matter if I'm level 1 or if I'm level 50 if the challenge is all the same? Well, in terms of the challenge, that's correct. But if you were level 50 and the world was no longer a challenge, you're not playing our game anymore. And the world is not the same. Instead of fighting the same old creatures you've fought time after time after time because you've refused to level up, because there's some potential advantage in that, you now get fresh experiences. And those fresh experiences, I think, are more valuable to the gamer than something as subtle as whether or not I'm more powerful than I ought to be, putting quotes around the word ought there. So you still have a desire to level up, because you'll get to see the new items, you'll get to see the new quests, you'll get to see the new creatures. And that experience is what is joyful about Oblivion.
Definitely makes sense. And quite frankly, I think it worked, you know, at least for me. You know, the way I played it is that, you know, the way it works, if you go to sleep, you level up. I purposely got to very quickly early in the game where, you know, I would not sleep for very long periods of time. And then when I decided I wanted to see something new, I'd eventually go to sleep and I would almost control my leveling up. you know, did you find a lot of people played it that way? It was almost like, you know, I didn't want to skip the content too quickly. I almost wanted to spend time with the glass, you know, glass armor and the glass weapons before I went to whatever came after glass. I forgot, you know, before you saw the ebony armor, you know, you wanted to spend some time there. How did you find that people are playing the game?
We don't have a easy way to get a true statistical study of anything, but the experiences that we've been told about in forums and other places where we do get feedback, most people do not do that. I think there's a dedicated hardcore audience that does that, and one unintended side effect is this is a choice you can make. But we didn't see it that way when we put it together. I'll be really honest with that. We just saw it as something you had to do, and it never occurred to us you wouldn't sleep to level up. That's that's not something that actually resonated as people would want to do this. But if you enjoy playing the game that way, if that helps you enjoy it more, then go for it. Because it's your game. It's not our game. We made it, but it's your play experience. It's not our play experience. So for those people that find that the leveling system is too fast or that their particular character archetype needs a little extra juice in order to be able to handle the world, or maybe they're not as facile with the controllers, this is something that they can do. This is an option that they have instead of having to play with the difficulty slider. They can choose to not level up and let some of those secondary skills that can be important for gameplay get more powerful before they level up.
So were you surprised that there was so much being written, and still to this day is being written about the leveling system? And well, you can't find an article about Oblivion where they don't talk about that. It's like, you know, yeah, there's the graphics and how successful it is and all this, but they always talk about the leveling system. I still read about it to this day.
It was not what we anticipated. I will be honest, we didn't think that was going to be it, but I've been in this industry a long time, and my experiences are that anytime you make a product that catches the public's imagination and catches attention, there's going to be an unexpected good and an unexpected bad. And I don't know that I call this an unexpected bad, but it was an unexpected topic of conversation. I'm very intrigued by it. I read all of it. I'm actually fascinated by the whole process, because we have to obviously go back and we're looking at the next game. We have to decide, what do we want to do? Do we continue on the same path? Do we modify it a little bit? Do we take a sharp left and go take the other path that we abandoned early on? What do we do? And I think there's been a tremendous amount of good feedback. I actually love reading this stuff, because there's some very sharp people out there with some very spot-on comments about what's good and what's bad about it.
I mean, the way I was playing, you know, for those who are not so familiar with Oblivion, you know, the more you emphasize your main core skills, then the more they go up. But it's possible for you to level up without emphasizing all your core skills. And I hit this one point where when I was leveling up, and it was something like 6 levels in a row, where I was only able to add 2 out of 5 points to all my core skills. And I was very, to be honest, I was depressed and disappointed about it, because I was like, you know, great, it's gonna, you know, I wasn't paying attention to how I was building my character. And then I, you know, stopped playing for a little while, and then I came across a little cheat, you know, because since I'm on the PC, that allows you to just add +5 to all your skills whenever you level up. Except for luck, you can still only add +1. And immediately, the game was so much more enjoyable. You know, I could play it the way I wanted. I didn't have to worry about, you know, concentrating on just my core skills. I knew I was going to get those 5 points. You know, are those things that you guys are thinking about and, you know, trying to figure out how is it going to work for the next game or the next time? Are you going to use the same system now? Are you going to really try to invest and tweak it? Or are you just going to do like, well, we're just going to come up with the system and then let the players sort of figure out the way they would like to play the game?
Well, there's 2 answers to that question. First of all, we haven't made our decisions for what we're doing for the next game, so we don't know how we're going to approach it. However, I was fortunate enough to be around for the original development of Daggerfall. I was part of that team when the whole concept of as you use it, it improves was first put out there for the Elder Scrolls line. That is a staple of this game. And what that gives Oblivion, and will give all the Elder Scrolls games, is the ability to have the player do what you just mentioned a minute ago. Play the game and not worry about that number side. You just play. And as you play, those things that you do get better. And it's what you want to get better, because it's what you're doing. So it's very organic, and it becomes a matter of, I'm just playing. I don't have to sit there and pay attention to min-maxing all these numbers. That gets in the way of the game, at least in my opinion. I want people to just play and enjoy and have a good time. So that is something we will do. That is something we will stick with, at least as far as I continue to have influence in that. But in terms of how we deal with the precise mechanics of leveling and all that, yeah, that's under review, but we don't know what we're going to do.
So what is coming up next? We're talking about it, so we're like, okay, you know, obviously they came out with the Elder Scrolls, Oblivion, and then you came up with all the little content. Now you have the, quote, official expansion pack. You know what's coming next? It's like, okay, where's 5? You know, what's the next one coming out? But this one you've been working on a long time. I mean, you started on Shivering Isles since last year at this point. You've been working on this about a year or so, if not longer. So I have to imagine there's something else up there that you guys are working on.
Well, there will be an Elder Scrolls 5. I've now said almost everything I can say about it. No, it's way, way, way too early to be talking about that. Even with the time under our, even with the time behind us from when we finished Oblivion and been working on the Shivering Isles, as you know, that's just a blink in the eye in terms of development cycles in today's games. So it's way too early for us to make any definitive statements about TES 5.
But what about even 4? I mean, do you think they're going to be continuously releasing additional smaller packs? Because this has actually been great, almost an experiment point of view, because, a lot of people make fun of horse armor, but as you know, there's no such thing as bad press. And the horse armor really, first of all, I use it. I thought it's great. You know, it's like, I don't know what everyone's bitching about. It's like 250 and it keeps my horse alive. I haven't lost a single horse in the game since I started using it. Best 250 I ever spent, I'll tell you right now, for the game. But, it continuously keeps you in the press. You know, you now are this iconic moment for downloadable content that they're probably going to be talking about in 10, 15, 20 years time, and people obviously enjoy it and like it, and it's working. So, for even the future of just Oblivion, are you going to continuously think, and I'm not trying to hold you to anything so you can answer this, continuously release additional smaller content to keep the game alive and vibrant, or is it going to be a mixture of this and bigger content, or just bigger content like these expansions?
We do have at least one more downloadable content that I know is coming. Plans beyond that are a little bit murky. Not because we don't want to produce the downloadable content, but because we have to sit back and take a look at the amount of time and effort it takes to put that out relative to stealing that time and effort away from other projects that we're working on. So there will come a point at which the scales will tip in the other direction. But for right now, we do have one more downloadable content piece that will be coming out. And as to the horse armor, an interesting, dirty little secret. Other than Knights of the Nine, it is the most popular downloadable content we have produced. More people have downloaded horse armor than any other thing. And there was a lot of negative press early. I think it had to do with people who had... Nobody had seen any downloadable content at this point. I mean, we were really pioneers of this new thing that Microsoft was allowing us to do. And they saw it, and there was an immediate backlash, and they didn't have anything to compare it to. So we lowered the price a little bit, and it all went away. Mm-hmm. I think most of it was because they didn't get to play something. Mm-hmm. And so if you'll notice, if you look at the other downloadable content we provided, you get to play something. Mm-hmm. Our initial thoughts were people will be happy with the equivalent of new music or having a new screen border. I mean, you've seen some of the other kinds of things you can download, and we thought the same thing would be true, but our gaming audience is more discriminating than that. They actually wanted to play something, shocker of shockers. Mm-hmm. So we gave them what they wanted.
Yeah. But now you're part of gaming culture history forever and ever. I mean, This couldn't have been much better for you guys. You're able to come up with horse armor, and probably just by miffing the price point by like 50 cents or so, you're able to now be the bane of jokes forever. I just read it the other day in another magazine. I'm like, they're never going to let this die, ever.
Well, that goes back to there's no such thing as bad press. I will let them talk about horse armor as long as they want to, because they're talking about us. They're talking about horse armor. And they can talk all they want. It's still one of the most downloaded pieces we ever produced, even at the higher price point. Mm-hmm. So, we also want to be a company that adapts and learns from things that happen. If our gaming public tells us this isn't what we want, we don't want to sit in some ivory tower and say, you're wrong, we know better than you. We don't know better than you. You're the guys who are playing this. So we want to pay attention to you. And we did. We reacted almost immediately to that negative press. The next one we put out, which was very shortly after it, was immediately dropped in price point, immediately had much more playable content, and people loved it. And they've loved all of them since then. I think Horse Armor is the only one that received any negative press, and I would actually say its negative press isn't really truly warranted at this point.
Plus, it's the most popular one, as you said. Because, you know what? It's like you want to protect your horse.
Well, Knights of the Nine, I think, actually has exceeded it in popularity. And there's a couple that are fast approaching it. But right now, as we sit here, yeah, it's been downloaded more times than anything else.
Oh, and real quick, I forgot to talk about this before, but with Shivering Isles, I noticed that there actually appeared to be, behind the scenes, some upgrades in the actual technology. Like, one of the things I noticed is, I have a killer rig, and I'm playing Oblivion even just last night. I was playing it, and I still get pop-ins, and I have an 880 XT, and it is, it's still at the very, very highest level. I still managed to still see things popping in. But when I was playing Shivering Isles, I didn't see any pop in. I didn't see any real graphical issues that I was experiencing with the original Oblivion. So there is something going on back there?
Well, we've been releasing updates. Not a ton of them, but enough to keep everything running smoothly. And the latest one, which you will need to be able to play Shivering Isles, includes that particular update. It was something that we weren't happy with in the original version. It wasn't something that prevented you from playing or enjoying the game, but we weren't happy with the fact that if you traveled too far overland, the game would hitch there for a moment as it tried to load the next place. And so that's something that Todd Howard in particular directed our technical staff. He really wanted that out. He wanted that gone. So it's gone on all platforms now. As soon as you get that update, that feature is available for you.
So what's some of your favorite parts of the original Oblivion, just out of curiosity, being a designer in the game? Personally, I like I talk about this with other people who played it. I mean, still, even though it was pretty early in the game, the paintbrush worlds, when you go into the oil painting, I almost wish the whole game was like that. It was so amazing. I still load it up every so often just to see the beautiful, sort of tinted colors, the sort of, oil-based paint in a world. It was pretty amazing, and something I haven't really seen in too many other games.
One of the beauties of working on a game like Oblivion, where you've got such an open world and so many places, is each one of the people that's designing material can go in a different direction. They can really express their individuality, and you can get a really wide range of ideas. That particular quest is cited a lot as being really popular, but you wouldn't be able to do that in a lot of other games because you'd have to stick to the theme a lot more tightly. Our game allows for that variety. I have to admit, I'm partial to the Thieves Guild, but that's because I worked on the Thieves Guild. That's the part I did. So it's not really a fair judgment, but the painted world is very popular. There's a number of the quests. The Galarthir quest, we get a bunch of comments on that. The crazy guy who hangs out in Skingrad. There's just a lot of good moments. I'm particularly fond of some of the Daedric quests. Shae Goroth's Daedric quest, for instance, I think is a hoot, where the rains burning dogs. I think that's...
I didn't see that one. Actually, I was going to ask you that next. Is there anything, if you're not doing the main storyline, what are some of the places you recommend people who are still playing the game or have finished the game should go back and try to check out that have some pretty cool things? Where was those burning dogs?
That's the Daedric quest for Shae Goroth. Okay. It is actually the only quest that has any alterations if you load up the Shivering Isles, because we felt it wasn't appropriate to leave it totally alone. So we made some adjustments so that the story wouldn't feel like it was conflicting. You can still run that quest, but at certain stages, that quest will take slightly different paths in order to adapt itself to what's going on with the Shivering Isles. But if you go find the Daedric statue of Shae Goroth, he will tell you what he wants you to do, and it ends up causing all kinds of wonderful madness and mayhem in the town that he wants all this stuff to happen.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I do is I actually have a little notebook. I told my friend about this because he, you know, one of the nice things about the game is that if you go back to a place that you've already looted, it repopulates and respawns. But when it downsizes, you kind of forget. So I actually have a little notebook. I keep track of all the caves I've been in and at places I've been. So at least now I know which ones I've been to. And it is not even, I mean, I've been playing this game a year now and I'm still not even scratching the surface. I mean, it's just too much in this game. I mean, it really is. It's just too much. And some of these levels just take forever to do. I mean, I'm just amazed that, you know, I mean, I've done game development for a long time myself. It's just the, you know, the amount of work that was done in this game. I mean, you guys must just be almost like daring each other to make, oh, you think this level's big? Wait till you see this one. You guys are just daring each other to make these insanely crazy side quests and side areas that have nothing to do with the main storyline just to keep us going nuts here.
Well, there's definitely that drive. Every person who's working on the game has a sense of pride in the things they want to do. So you get somebody who's putting together a dungeon, he just doesn't want to slap together some corridors for you. You know, he wants something special in there. And they want something special everywhere. And we encourage that. We want something special everywhere. We don't want there to be ordinary dungeons. They're just, you know, some rooms with some critters in them. So there's very few of those in Oblivion as a result, because we let these guys express themselves creatively. We let them put some of that stuff in there, and it's some of the best moments in there. One of my favorite dungeons is under Paul Cave, and you walk in and your eyes just bug out. It's like, whoa, I never thought of that. That's really cool. And none of the story guys came up with that. That was all done by one of the level designers that puts together the dungeon, and you know, he got big kudos for that.
So what would you like to see in the game that, what would you like to see in the next version of Oblivion that, that hasn't been in, you know, hasn't been touched upon, or what would you think that would be a good addition to the series?
That's a tough question.
Kind of put you on the spot, but this could be a wish list. This doesn't, yeah, won't get you in trouble.
I'd like to see the whole conversation system get to be a little more organic. I think that'd be a wish list item. It's no guarantee that that can be done given the staggering amount of voice recordings that we made for Oblivion in the first place. I mean, we had, if I remember the number correctly, 38,000 voice recordings. That's an insane amount of voice. And if we want to try and improve that system, that number would only get worse potentially. So, but that's one area I would like to see. I would like to see the leveling system become something that everybody appreciated and caused a little less controversy. And I think based on a lot of the feedback we've read, we might have some ideas for that. We'll have to see how they pan out when the rubber hits the road. I'd like to see all kinds of cool places in the world that have a high fantasy twist to them. I think trying to stretch that a little bit would also be a cool thing. But, you know, when you make a game of this scope and this size, what happens is everybody involved in it puts all their wish lists into a big bucket, and there's a limited number of slips of paper that get drawn out. You know, not that we literally do that, but there's a limit to what you can do. So we'll have to see if any of my wish list items make it, or if somebody else's ideas prove to be better and theirs make it in instead.
Well, with that said, I do want to thank you, Bruce, for taking time out, and I look forward to the next downloadable content / expansion / Oblivion 5.
I do, too. I think it's going to be a lot of fun to work on.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Bruce.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Bruce. And with that, I'm going to get to my preview of Oblivion Shivering Isles and tell you guys what I thought of it. So let's get to the preview.
Game previews.
So, you know, Oblivion Shivering Isles comes out today. It's available both on the 360 and the PC. And the preview, I would say, it's very simple. I played it for quite a bit, and if you really love Oblivion, then you should buy this. It's really that simple. It just adds more of what you love. You know, I played Oblivion kind of to death, even though I still haven't finished it. I got to go through the main quest. I'm just having so much fun doing everything else. It's like I almost don't want to do it, but you know, immediately when I loaded it up, and it was new to me, as you know, it was old but yet new to me, or should I say it was very familiar, but it was all brand new. And right away, you can see the designers kind of went hog wild crazy. They put in really crazy quests. They've put in very original monsters. They've put in tons of equipment. They put in new sets of armor all over the place. There's whole new sets of crafting of the armor, which is a lot of fun. And something that I'll give you a little trick, a little secret of game design, is that whenever I find out that something's been designed, I always try to find out which of the quests or which areas were done later. For example, in World of Warcraft, the Alliance was done first and then the Horde was done. And a lot of people, myself included, find the Horde, actually the quests are a lot more fun and it's just a little bit more polished. And that's just true of, you know, because, you know, the Alliance stuff was done first, so they were still a little, you know, raw with it. And then later they get really, you know, they get really comfortable with the tool sets. They understand the process and the game a little bit more, so they're able to do a little bit more crazy things. And this is just true of any game. And it seems like with Shivering Isles, the designers went hog wild crazy, and they put in really, really insane quests. They've been, you know, they just went, well, they just went nuts. You know, they were trying to think of all the insane things they can do. And since this takes place sort of like in the realm of madness, kind of, it totally fits. You know, even the towns are incredibly bizarre. The graphics themselves are beautiful. The sky looks, actually, if you played the expansion of World of Warcraft, it looks kind of in the Outland, it looks incredibly similar to that. It's just sort of like the, you know, sky is multicolored stars and reds and blues and greens. And it's absolutely beautiful. There's about 30 new areas. And you can play this at any point in time. You can, you know, finish the game and then go to the expanded area. You can start a brand new character, go to the expanded area. You know, it's totally self-contained, so you can go and play this at any point. I played it for only about 4 hours, which really is actually quite a bit for, you know, an expansion. But, you know, if you are just, you know, hankering for some more Oblivion and you just love it, this is a total no-brainer. You should definitely get this right away and give it a try. Again, it's not a full review. I couldn't tell you, like, on a scale of 1 to 10 what I would give it, but I can tell that the people and the designers of the game really put a lot of thought and effort into these levels and into the quests, and they really wanted to make sure that if you've played this game for a couple of hundred hours and you've seen everything, you can play this and this stuff will be brand new. There'll be things in here you've never seen before. You're fighting monsters and creatures that are, you know, 4 stories, 5 stories tall. And then later you're doing crazy things with those creatures. I don't want to give anything away. So definitely check it out. And with that, let's get to my review of Command & Conquer 3.
This is Joe Kukin from Command & Conquer 3, and you're listening to Gaming Steve.
Game Review! Game Review! Game Reviews!
So thanks a lot, Joe Kukin. That was Kane. That's right. Kane himself is introducing his own review. So that's a little weird, though, because he sounded so nice. You know, he actually is. He's the nicest guy, this guy, Joe Kukin. And, you know, he was originally just an employee at Westwood and, you know, stepped in to play Kane. I think he was only 19 at the time. And if you look at him now in Command & Conquer 3, he's like 31, I believe. I believe that's correct ages. Joe, if I messed that up, I'm sorry. But he looks exactly the same. So that means, Joe, you look like a 19-year-old. That's awesome. But no, seriously, he looks and plays Kane really, really well. But with that said, Command & Conquer 3, it's coming out for the PC today. It's going to come out for the 360 in a few months from now. And I can tell you right now that this game, in my opinion, is a real accomplishment. It takes you back to Red Alert, which was my favorite Command & Conquer game. This game is incredibly fast. You know, I'll divide it up. You know, of course, it plays exactly like, well, the old, you know, old style Command & Conquer is that, you know, you have your nod, you have the you have the nod, and then you have the GDI. I couldn't remember it. It's like, what happened to me? You have the GDI, and then of course you have the new, you know, mysterious third race. You know, I'm not going to give anything away, but if you really don't want to hear, just put your hands in ears. But there's aliens, the Scar, and that they're in the game as well. But, you know, they do everything. They have hokey cutscenes, but they're really not that hokey. It's like they're kind of, you know, they're made kind of hokey, but on purpose. And, of course, they have Michael Ironside and then Billy Dee Williams and Trisha Helfner and Joe Coogan and Grace Park from Battlestar as well. And the man, I can't remember, Josh from Josh Whedon, Welton, the guy who plays Sawyer on Lost. Of all the people in their acting, I would say that Joe Coogan and Sawyer were really the best. They were very good. Actually, and Trisha Helfer, she was extremely good as well. But, you know, they're purposely kind of hokey. And it's exactly what you want. It's like if you're looking for, you know, incredibly serious full motion video, you're probably not going to find it in a video game because that's sort of the two are oxymorons. They really don't go together. But as for the gameplay itself, there's single player and multiplayer. The single player campaign is extremely, the good news is it's extremely varied. You know, some missions, they'll, you know, mix it up between base building missions as well as like little commando missions where you have to go and kill, you know, an entire base with just one unit. On top of that, there's bonus objectives that you can go in and take out, additional areas just for the heck of it. The other thing is that it's linear, but you have a little bit of choice in your mission selections. And then also, the actual story itself is pretty good. It's a fairly fun story. Without giving too much away, you know, basically Nod and GDR are fighting each other, and they're, you know, trying to kill each other off left and right, and then the aliens show up and sort of make a mess of everything. So it seems to be a common theme in video games this time around. The only downside I would say about the Command & Conquer 3 is that the AI is a little lacking, especially for real advanced players. They can probably breeze through this pretty fast. But, you know, I didn't really try it on the very hardest AIs. I was just trying out a normal. But from what I heard from some of the more advanced players, especially the German contingency that I was playing with, that the AI seemed a little simple. But, you know, the game is supposed to be, an introductory, and a lot of people actually don't even play the single-player missions, but if you're playing it for the single-player missions and you're, you know, a casual player, I think it would be absolutely fine. I don't think this is an issue at all. If you're a hardcore player, you're probably not going to play the single-player missions anyhow. You're probably going to jump right to the multiplayer. And let's get to the multiplayer. Multiplayer, I think, is fantastic, and this is where the game really shines. If you're really into Company of Heroes type tactical play, this will probably not be your cup of tea. This is probably not the game for you. It's not a real turtling game. It's not incredibly defensive. You can play defense, but it's tricky. The game is fast. How fast? Well, you can go from zero to actually your super weapon and tier 3 technology in 5 to 6 minutes. And games can easily be over. And I've seen games end in 2 or 3 minutes. And I think one of the longest games I saw was 12 minutes. Most games seem to last about 8 minutes approximately. So is that good or is that bad? Depends. If you really like very fast style gameplay, if you're into, you know, incredibly fast swarms, if you're into, you know, different tactics of like getting engineers behind there and trying to, you know, sabotage bases, if you're into, playing 5 or 6 games in an hour instead of having to play one game and then you know you're going to lose in 20 minutes, and then you quit the game, and then you never see the actual end of a game, you know, then this is the type of game for you. Personally, I enjoy very fast gameplay because I would rather play, you know, 2 or 3 of these games in a row within half an hour and maybe do it best 2 out of 3. I really much more enjoy that than just one long game that takes, you know, 45 minutes to an hour to play where, you know, sort of the end is predetermined. And there's definitely a lot of tactics involved with each, you know, side. You know, the GDI have, you know, incredibly strong, powerful units. The Nod, of course, have this sort of quick, stealthy, not as powerful units, but much faster. And then the SCAR, the alien race, is sort of something in between. Another aspect of the multiplayer, which is really great, is that it has these tools if you're going to be using multiplayer. And that is fantastic, is that you can actually do conferencing and sort of play-by-play. You can have like a little whiteboard. You can actually record play-by-play, and then this is going to go up. And we didn't actually get to see this, but it was there's going to be a website called RTS Sport, and you're going to actually be able to go up and download these replays, even if you don't own Command & Conquer 3. And this is, I think, going to be a real this is going to be something that's going to be standard in the industry very soon. You're going to start seeing this embedded into pretty much every single RTS game from now on, and this will probably be one of the standards. This has been around before, but I mean, I was talking to the guys from the GGL, the gaming league, and you know, they couldn't get enough of it. They thought it was fantastic because this is what these guys do for a living, is, you know, do commentary on multiplayer matches, and these were tools they've been waiting for their entire lives. I was talking to several people who also do a lot of multiplayer gaming, and they themselves were just stunned, and they wish this was in other games. You know, a lot of them were playing Age of Empires, and they just wish that these tools were in Age of Empires. So, you know, it does, you know, it's sort of a strange game. It's very retro, but yet it does a lot of things new. You know, standard game resource gathering, you have Tiberium. The graphics are they're very small, but really well done. You know, examples are like, there'll be a tennis court, and if your tanks are rolling through a tennis court, you'll actually see, you know, the fences get knocked down. You'll see terrain get blown up. It's, you know, it's so subtle, you almost don't notice it. But it's very effective, and it definitely adds to the atmosphere of the game. You know, for myself, is you know, I personally like very fast RTSs. I really enjoyed the Command & Conquer universe and the style of tanks and the style of play in the game itself. Everything, you know, if you're familiar with the Scorpion tanks, and if you're familiar with the Predators, and, you know, the Hand of Nod and all the other, you know, crazy stuff, and of course the you know, the commando units, that's all in there. So, you know, immediately you'll be right at home. You'll recognize everyone. You'll be like, oh yeah, and you'll be like an old friend. Of course, when you do play the alien race, you'll be like, whoa. The alien race is definitely alien. I would say that I didn't quite get used to it, actually, after 2 days of playing. I definitely need a few more days of playing it to get the hang of it. But I think that's actually great. You know, it's the first time where I actually saw an alien race that felt alien, as opposed to just sort of a, you know, another human race with just different look and feel. This actually was sort of an alien race where, like, your infantry unit was sort of a swarm of insects, and I wasn't quite sure what the heck was going on there. And they just are incredibly strong and just take out, you know, other infantry units very quickly. And even their one of the most powerful weapons in the game, this mothership that is that will just devastate everything on the field. And interesting little tactic of how to get that onto the field. And, you know, again, just, I can see there's a lot of fun different tactics. And then something else of when I was there at the summit, where we're actually playing this with some of the best players in the world, I was watching these guys from Germany, and you can see, you know, one of the things is I was able to see multiple tactics and multiple methods of playing the game in multiplayer, and all of them were successful. And that's something you like to see. You'll like to see multiple ways to win the game. And, you know, so, you know, this was based on the Battle for Middle-earth 2 engine. So these guys were able to really do their homework. They were able to actually test this out thoroughly. You know, so in the 360, it's going to be really good. You can see it, you know, a lot of the interfaces are very, very similar. And I won't give anything away, but one of my absolute favorite parts of all time, of all gaming, in Command & Conquer 1 was the installation screen. Was when you actually installed the game, it was an adventure itself, and it was something you didn't forget. Well, I'm not going to tell you why or when this happens, but there's something extremely similar in Command & Conquer 3, and that alone made me happy. There is a part of the game where the interface will become part of the game itself, and it is really, really cool. And it's that attention to detail that really made Command & Conquer 3, at least for me, stand out as one of the best RTSs I've played in a really, really long time, and one of the best versions of Command & Conquer in the entire series. So for Command & Conquer 3, on a scale of 1 to 10, I give it a 9 out of 10. Definitely check it out if you're into RTSs, if you're into fast RTSs, if you're into Command & Conquer. There's really no reason. And for the 360 version, I would just say wait. If that's the one you want, I saw that one as well, and it also has a few very cool features. You can actually use the camera and view the people you're playing against, and we actually saw Kane play, although I don't think it was really playing, but that itself was quite a bit of fun. So definitely check it out. And with that, let's get to viewer mail.
Show mail.
So it's been a long time since I've done viewer mail, so I didn't have a huge amount to actually read, but I have a few. And if you want to ask me a question, you know, if you send me an MP3 around 30 seconds or less in length to feedback@gamingsteve.com, I'll put it on the air, or you can just write me a question. And first I have RacingFreak92. He wrote, "Hey, Steve, I listened to your latest episode of your podcast, and I'm interested in getting into game design and wanted to know what language or program you think I should start with. I eventually want to go on to XNA, but think it will be too complicated to start with. RacingFreak92. That is, actually, I just gave a talk this week of how to get into the game industry. And, well, if you're going to do hardcore programming, C++, C is really the, you know, the programming language you need to learn. But there's a lot of tools out there. You know, it depends really what you want to do. You know, if you want to be a level designer, you don't need to really know hardcore programming. You might have to know scripting, which isn't exactly programming. It's sort of putting together various instructions to allow something to happen. And that's sort of the Neverwinter Nights engine has that. XNA Toolkit has that as well. Summer Flash has that. So, you know, I would say C. C is the language you really want to learn. But, you know, look at what you want to do. If you want to do level design, then I would, you know, get some level design toolkits. If you want to do scripting, you can use XNA or Torque. Even better, use the Torque engine. And you can try that out. You could build nice little games with that. Even Flash. Flash, you know, is a great tool, and it's, you know, it's sort of walking before you run, but it helps. But I would definitely recommend also you take courses, because one thing is when you learn professional programming, you learn methodology and structure, and that is really, really helpful. That's the difference between, say, professional programmers and home-taught programmers. Is I've seen a lot of superb programmers that are incredibly raw, that they know how to program, but they're really bad with structure and the structure of their code. And then when you learn professional programming, you learn how to really organize your code and comment it and make it very easy and efficient. So that's like the subtle difference. But I would definitely recommend you take some classes so you are taught the proper method to program. Next is, let's see, Billy Shank, the Danger Boy. Let's see, he wrote, "Cutting to the chase, here's my question. Nintendo came out of nowhere with a success that even you didn't see coming with the DS. Everyone, including myself, thought the DS was a gimmick that would spell certain doom for Nintendo, since Sony sexier PSP was coming. Well, the DS won the war undisputed and is making killing, but now it's rumored that the PSP2 is coming out with a touchscreen, hotness, and restructured layout. Can the DS stand up to the might of a PSP that fixes all of its shortcomings? And will the Wii be a flash in the pan now that the PS3 is showing its true power and potential? There's also a rumor Sony patenting software that mimics the Wii control, but a different way. So with both systems said to be underpowered by developers, how can Nintendo survive and thrive in the coming onslaught of Sony superior tech?" Wow. Is this a fanboy? I can't tell. But, well, yes, superior tech is nice, but market share is nicer. I actually took a course way back when in the Roman times when I went to college, and it was about technology and how the best technology actually doesn't always win. And it was, you know, interesting. It was about how, like, you know, Apple lost out to IBM, and how the Betamax lost out to the VHS, and how SideQuest beat Bernoulli discs, and so on and so forth. And, you know, time and time again, the best technology doesn't always win. Better market share and lower price will usually beat it. You know, there's, you know, it's extenuating circumstances. Things are different nowadays. The way, you know, people disseminate information on the internet changed a lot of things. But, you know, it's really a catch-up. I mean, you know, Sony can come out with a PSP2, but, you know, they can only change it so much because it has to be backwards compatible. So maybe they'll put on a second joystick so it'll be a little bit easier to convert PSP. You know, PS2 games, so many PSs here. It's like PS2, PSP, PlayStation 2 games to the PSP. So that would be a big help. A touchscreen, maybe. I mean, you know, I really don't want to be touching the screen while I'm playing. And even on the DS, it's used sparingly, especially nowadays. It's, you know, when it's used well most times. But I've played so many games where I've never even used a touchscreen. So, you know, the other thing is just that it could be too little too late. You know, the PSP is, you know, P, people follow market leaders. You know, EA didn't come out with a huge number of launch titles for the Wii. I think only two. And rumor is it that I've heard from various sources that they were getting, let's just say, a lot of trouble. A lot of people in EA got into a lot of trouble with that because, you know, no one expected the Wii to become such a monster success. Now this thing is selling like hotcakes and there's not enough, you know, games out for it. And EA didn't have anything, you know, really ready for it, and now they're quickly playing catch up. And you know, if Wii is the market leader, then people are going to make games for the Wii. The DS is the market leader, so people are making games for the DS, and people are going to make games for the PS2. The PSP. But you know, if it's going to cost a lot and there's less market share, there's just not as much incentive. And you know, it's like fool me once, shame on you; fool me twice, shame on me. You know. Maybe they could come with a new one, but Sony's going to have to prove themselves this time. People aren't going to just jump on this blindly. So again, superior technology does not always win. And I mean, look at the Wii. I mean, this thing is incredibly underpowered compared to the Xbox 360 and the PS3. It really just can't hold the candle, but you know, it's cheaper. It's a very, 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 very easy to use. It is converting non-gamers left and right. It's just cheap enough that a non-gamer can almost buy it as an impulse buy. And also, it's not being branded as, you know, if anything, it's being underbranded. You know, the PS3 is being branded as a home computer, a DVD, you know, Blu-ray player, next generation. And, you know, that's intimidating to your average non-gaming consumer. While the Wii is being, you know, almost branded as a fun toy that you can play games on, and people, you know, are almost, you know, like saying, oh, okay, that's all I really want. You know, I don't really want to pay for a Blu-ray player if I don't even have HD, so I don't need it. And plus, I already have DVDs. I know some of you out there who love Blu-ray are saying, what, you're crazy, Steve, but you know what? Trust me on this. There's a lot of people out there who couldn't care less about Blu-ray. And those are the ones that aren't going to care less about the PS3, but they will care about the Wii. And those are the people that are going to really change the direction of, you know, gaming for this millennium of gaming. So thank you, Billy Shank. Yes, whatever your name is. Next. Have you ever known Peter Molyneux to pull off anything? Seriously, we remember everything he said about Fable, and he got maybe one-tenth of it at best. Around this time, Fable's development, he was still saying there'd be male and female characters. I admit he's learning to temper his comments, but still, I'm not ready to accept anything that's going to be in the game until I actually see it in the game, like the dog. Regards, DWL. And he's talking about, of course, Fable 2, and I was impressed by it. Yeah, I don't know. Peter Molyneux, You're right. He is a superb showman. He hasn't had a really big hit in a long time. Fable was, but you know what? That's not true. Actually, I'm going to have to totally take that back, because Fable was not a critical success, but it was a commercial success. And in the end, that's what matters. That's why there's a Fable 2. I mean, you can look at Okami. Okami for the PS2 was a critical success, and gorgeous game, and a total failure. It just did not do well at all. And quite frankly, I actually found it quite boring. I actually fell asleep playing that game, which is kind of, it shows you there's a little bit too much cutscenes in the game when you're actually falling asleep. So, yeah, Peter Molyneux, I guess I have to be a little tempered by what he's saying, but the dog really did look very good. If you haven't seen the Fable 2 demo, go to GameSpot and check it out. There's a dog, and it has amazing artificial intelligence. The dog really does seem pretty incredible, and the dog is going to be a key component of the game system. You know, hopefully he learned a lot of lessons, and, you know, and hopefully he's getting a lot of help and resources from Microsoft to get him on track so he tempers and can do what he promises. And then finally, I have an email from Edwin, and he writes, I have a slight nit on something you and many, many others keep putting forth, the price of the PS3. It is not a $600 console. It is a $500 console. Unlike the Xbox 360, the PS3's lower-priced SKU is a fully functional machine. The extra $100 goes towards a bigger hard drive, a built-in 802.11, and some memory card slots, but does not impact the game or movie watching experience one iota, unlike the Xbox 360. Anyway, sorry to sound like one of the venomous fanboys out there. I'm really not. I guess I just want to speak my mind. Love the show. And blah, blah, blah. Edwin. Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, there is a lower version, and it can play just as well. You know, the $500 version does work as well as the $600 version. But, you know, they are trying to push the $600 version. You know, even Sony themselves wants to sell you the $600 version. And plus in America, you know, like the core, they say the core system is quite interesting. The core system, of course, does pretty horribly in America, but overseas it does extremely well. It actually, it does quite well because people, in other countries are just interested in, you know, spending less money than rather than getting more features. However, in America, it's usually the other way around. Usually, you know, if it's something's going to be, if you're going to spend $500, what's another $100 to get the next best version? You know, if it was $100 versus $200, I would probably agree with you that, yeah, there's a big difference, and that, you know, it is a $100 machine versus a $200 machine. And, you know, it's 100% increase, but here it's $500 versus $600. You know, if I'm going to spend $500, I'm not going to spend $500 and get the second best thing. I'm going to spend $600 and get the best thing because I'm already putting down that much money. Why would I really, you know, put down such a huge investment? You know, the other thing that, or if it was, say, a $250 machine versus a $500 machine, or even $300 versus $600, but, you know, it's $100. It's a $100 difference, and it is significant. You know what? Having wireless in this day and age is a big deal. Having a bigger hard drive is a big deal. Having memory card slots is a big deal. So, yes, there is a $500 machine out. There's a $600 machine out, but realistically, Sony, especially in the U.S., is expecting the $600 machine to way, way outsell the $500 machine. And if it was probably up to them, they would come out with the $500 machine. They only come out with the $600, you know, I'm getting confused. They, you know, want to come out just with the $600 machine and totally ignore the $500 machine. They just did it so, because if this thing came out, it was only $600. Oh my God, if you thought the press was bad now, it would have just gotten worse. So I see where you're coming from, but I'll be more impressed when it drops, to $400, or when it can compete directly with the 360. And also, quite frankly, Sony knows that, you know, in the first, you know, 6 months to the year of the life cycle, the only people that are going to buy this thing are the hardcore fans anyhow, the ones that are willing to spend that much money. Unfortunately, they might have underestimated just how many people were that hardcore and really willing to spend that much money, because it really was not quite maybe what they expected. Although the number's comparable to what the 360 was selling last year, they're almost identical. They're pretty close. So maybe Sony isn't as, you know, maybe just Wii is messing everything up, and maybe the Wii is just selling too much. You know, if the Wii wasn't out and it was just Sony versus Xbox, they could probably show, look, we're doing just as well as Xbox did at this period of time, so, and ours is a superior machine, blah, 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 but the Wii is really making them all look bad right now. So, thanks for the questions. Again, if you have anything, just send me feedback at Gaming Steve, and I'll put it on the air. Especially if you send me voice, I always like the voicemail questions. And with that, let's get to final thoughts.
Gaming Steve's final thoughts.
So, final thoughts for this week. What do I have? I'm blank. oh yeah, one good thing is, yeah, I believe it or not, I am still in mourning. You know, when I was in LA a few weeks ago, and then also in San Francisco for the Game Developers Conference, I mean, it was just, I just, you know, I was thinking to myself, I'll probably never be in LA anymore, because I was coming here every year for E3. That was the main reason to go to LA, and I had a whole routine. I'd visit my friends, I'd visit my brother. You know, it's just, it was also such a fun event. But I was invited to the new E3 a few weeks ago. Of course, I responded, so I'm going to be going. It's in July. No one in the industry seems to know what the heck it's going to be about, or what it's going to be like, or where it's going to be, or how it's going to work. But hey, it's in the LA area, so I'm pretty excited, and I think it's going to be fun for everyone. But I do find it interesting that everyone is now jumping into this void. I went to the Comic-Con, the New York Comic-Con, a few weeks ago, which was really fantastic, and there was so much gaming at the Comic-Con, and not just gaming, but good gaming. Like, The Darkness was on display. That game looked really good, by the way. Incredibly violent, but it really looked like a good game. And I was just, I couldn't believe how many, you know, games were on display. So you're starting to see that more and more at all these other conferences. I will say that the E for Everyone Expo, or I think that's what it's called, you know, that's coming out in October, that, I'm definitely going to skip that one. That will probably be a total insane madhouse, and will also probably show games that are coming out that Christmas. They're not going to probably show anything new, anything that, you know, game journalists or people in the media haven't seen before. So if you do plan on going to that, I would probably recommend strongly that you get there early, because I think the lines are going to be outrageous. I think they're going to get a lot of good press on that, but I do think the lines are going to be a little nuts. Anyhow, with that, I'm going to go, because I got to cut the show together and put it up for all you guys out there. And I will talk to you guys next week. I hope pretty soon, within a week or two. I'm trying to get the show up on a regular basis as usual. A weekly show is going to be a little tricky, but I imagine every 2 weeks for a while until I move into my new house with an actual studio for me to record it, I'll be able to sneak in a show here and there. And I have a few surprises coming up. So with that, I will talk to you guys later. I will see you around, and have a good gaming week.
Listening to Gaming Steve. Until next week, hey, how about reading a goddamn book for a change?